Vinny?
Yeah, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Thank you to all of those listening in the chat room. My very special guest is Mike Billington. Don't turn on your camera, Mike. It's not that kind of a show.
Okay.
It'll just be me, my pretty face. Mike Billington from LaRouchePack.com is my guest today for 2 hours. I had him on for an hour at one point before, and I had such a good time with him that I thought, you know what, I think 2 hours would actually be far more appropriate. So, Mike, welcome to the program.
Oh, glad to be here. Can you hear me all right?
Hey, you're just fine. And for those who don't know about you and LaRouchePack, maybe you could give us a wee bit of an explanation.
An explanation? Well, I think probably most people do know about, maybe not about me, but about LaRouche and LaRouchePack. We often have a story about how the media pretends that nobody knows who LaRouche is, but you can go to virtually any meeting anywhere in the world, and if you just start the rumor that LaRouche is here, you'll see panic ensue. Now, LaRouche has become, is probably the world's foremost economist, and that's said with no reservations. He has for, well, how much now? Close to 50 years. Actually, a little bit more than 50 years, been the only person who has completely accurately forecast every major economic downturn. And when I say forecast, I don't mean predict. I don't mean that he has a crystal ball and predicts downturns. He forecasts in the sense that he lays out the insanity of certain measures being pursued. He proposes alternatives and warns that barring those alternatives being implemented, you will necessarily see such and such a result. He's been correct on this since his forecast of the 1958 recession under Eisenhower. And I could go through about 9 or 10 of these, but emphatically, he has warned since the 2007-2008 crisis, which he also warned was imminent, that the entire Western financial system was doomed. If we were not to end the insanity of the British free market, free trade policy that dominates the monetary system, the world monetary system. And in fact, if we did not do away with monetary systems altogether and restore in the United States the original intention of the Constitution, which was a creditary system, and to help bring about a global policy parallel to that of the creditary system of the United States, and emphatically based on the Glass-Steagall legislation from Roosevelt. So LaRouche has become an extremely controversial figure. He's been proven to have been, as I said, the only competent economist. And the alternatives he lays out, as you know, Vinny, have been predicated on the idea that the human race must, in fact, use its creative powers to expand upon the technological and productive capacities of the human race at a certain pace to deal with the attrition that takes place under any economic system, and that failing to do so will lead to a not only national but global collapse of the sort we're seeing exactly carried through today, pretty much dominating the Anglo the European and American system structure, which is in a state of absolute panic and absolute collapse, not having yet affected Asia, which is still on a positive directory in terms of technology, production, and so forth. But it will hit Asia. Asia is not immune to this, and they know it. And the British know it. And therefore, LaRouche's other key forecast that were we not to reverse this global economic breakdown crisis of the collapse of the transatlantic monetarist system, that we would be heading rapidly towards war, global war, thermonuclear global war. And indeed, we are now on the brink, closer to global war than the world has ever been, far more so than we were on the brink of World War I and II, a war that would target Asia, as LaRouche has warned, both because the British Empire and their minions on Wall Street and elsewhere cannot tolerate to see Asia progressing as it does while the entire Western financial and economic system is in a state of complete collapse. And because their ultimate goal is to reduce the world's population, as Prince Philip likes to say, to a more manageable number of 1 billion or so, i.e. eliminating the other 6 or so billion. And where are the people? Well, they're in Asia. So launching war on Russia and China and India is very much not only acceptable, but perhaps even preferred by the global financial empire, which is known as the British Empire. And that's LaRouche's role, proposing the alternative, restoring the idea that man is capable of living in the image of God, as you'd say in Christianity, or various other terms for the same idea in other religions or non-religions, but that our creative powers, which distinguish us from the beast, must be utilized at this point to overturn the rapid descent into fascist forms of government, the destruction of national sovereignty as desired by the empire, and restoring the commitment to science and technology and to a cultural renaissance, which must cohere with that fight, a return to great culture, to great music, to great art, instead of the popular culture of crap and noise and ugliness, which has come to dominate most of Western civilization today.
If anything, he's asking for a neo-renaissance for people to cast off the shackles of financial terrorism. And the British Empire, and by that I mean the Rothschild Empire, because they own England, has had that depopulation and collapse of the global economy agenda for quite some time. And Glass-Steagall was only repealed like recently, like as much as the late 90s. And a lot of people need to understand this legislation a bit more. Basically, it means that you can't go to a casino and act as though it's a financial institution, in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's very accurate. This is what Roosevelt recognized when he was elected, that he took office virtually the same day that that Hitler was put in power in Germany. And he recognized that fascism had swept through Europe through the Montague Norman's network at the Bank of England, that the financial institutions centered in London and Paris had effectively created fascist movements to the purpose of imposing vicious austerity on nations, in the case of Germany, to pay their debt from World War I, and similar kinds of conditions under Mussolini in Germany earlier and in Spain, but that it had been done through the banking system, which was facing a similar global bankruptcy as we are facing today. Today being far, far worse because of the scope of the multi-trillion, perhaps quadrillion-dollar financial bubble created by the derivative fiasco under Greenspan and subsequently. But nonetheless, he saw that it was the banking system itself that was bringing fascism in and was trying to bring it into the United States. His first act as president, literally within hours of the inauguration, was to declare a banking holiday, meaning the entire banking system was shut down cold. And every bank had to demonstrate that they had dealt with the massive speculative junk on their books before they would be allowed to be opened. Many never reopened. Those who showed that they were capable of writing off the junk were given federal support, not to bail out debt, not the kind of bailouts we see today in the U.S. and in Europe, bailing out useless, wasted, speculative gambling debts, as you pointed out. No, these were credits extended by the government to banks only when they'd wiped out the junk. And there were strings attached to the extension of that credit. It had to go into those things necessary for the general welfare that we have in our Constitution, meaning industry, infrastructure, agriculture, schools and hospitals, the things required to expand the productivity of the population, to expand the productivity of the nation. And by doing this, he made it possible. He also, by the way, implemented something called the Pecora Commission. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
The Pecora Commission was set up immediately in the Senate. Pecora was a U.S. attorney in New York, a hard-nosed Italian attorney. And he was brought in to run a Senate investigation into the financial collapse of the 1920s and 30s. And basically brought all the bankers in to testify before the Congress, including J.P. Morgan himself, who tried to ridicule it. But he was forced to get in to testify, and the entire American nation listened in on radio. And this was a public demonstration of the criminality of Wall Street, brought to us care of Pecora and Roosevelt in the Senate. And as a result, the population came to understand what had been done to them, and therefore supported en masse the policies that Roosevelt proposed. The Glass-Steagall Act, which was the fundamental separation of the speculators from the commercial banking system. The speculators were going to be allowed to continue to exist in the form of these investment banks, but they had absolutely no government guarantee. If they wanted to invest in whorehouses and casinos, well, there were, we'd try to stop some of that too, you know. But by and large, they would be allowed to speculate, but with no government guarantees. The government would never bail out their junk. And the commercial banking system was absolutely forbidden to participate in any kind of speculation, stocks and bonds, insurance, certainly no derivatives, hedge fund operations. And when they got in trouble, because their legitimate loans to legitimate productive industry, schools, hospitals, and so forth, when that ran into trouble, the government would back them up in order to help them get back in shape. That was the SEC and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, these institutions that were set up along with Glass-Steagall. So this worked. It worked up through the 1990s when Alan Greenspan, or 1987, when he came in immediately. Greenspan, who was Morgan Stanley, remember, part of the J.P. Morgan crowd, the British financial operative, following the so-called Austrian school, the von Hayek crowd, who argue unlimited free market, free trade, let the speculators and the criminals do what they will with no government restraint. So this crowd was effectively took over with Greenspan's coming in, especially worked to destroy Glass-Steagall, which was finally was taken down piece by piece, but finally eliminated in 1999 when Clinton was distracted with the impeachment. And this, the takedown,
I'm sure that wasn't the only thing he was distracted by.
Well, he was distracted by the impeachment because he allowed himself to be distracted by his pants. that's Bill Clinton's problem, is that he's a baby boomer, and the British imperial crowd knows how to manipulate people and play on their weaknesses, and they got into him by getting into his pants with a deployed asset named Monica Lewinsky, who was, by the way, part of Alan Greenspan's personal network. Do you know that story?
No.
You remember Monica Lewinsky's controller was this woman, Goldberg, who was a member of the Ayn Rand Society in New York, run by Alan Greenspan. So this was all part of this neoconservative financial crowd who carefully coordinated the work that that Monica Lewinsky did in setting up Obama setting up Clinton for what became, you know, the disaster of that impeachment. And while he was distracted, he got basically done in. Now, I have a lot more to say about Bill Clinton today, because the unfortunate reality is that Clinton and his circles, including his wife, were actually the only hope, the crucial hope, that the Democratic Party would be broken out of the current disastrous situation where they're supporting an outright neuropsychotic as their president and their presidential candidate, a man who has become one of the most disgusting, warmongering financial assets in the history of America, or perhaps the world, who, if he were a Republican, would be being denounced right and left by the Democratic base, by the trade union movement, by the people who represent production in the industrial sector. But they've succeeded in basically imposing this fraud, this sophist, this Nero psycho, who's on the verge of starting World War III, has decimated the U.S. economy, is pumping trillions of dollars into both the U.S. and Europe, creating a hyperinflationary bubble which will be destroyed, which is of the sort that we saw in Germany in 1923. And yet, Clinton, just in the last few weeks, effectively capitulated to what we were demanding that he and his associates do, which was to get Obama out one way or another, force him to resign, impeach him, use the 25th Amendment, which says that he's psychologically incompetent to serve. But they didn't. They've decided, well, the Republicans are worse, and they've capitulated totally. And now they are fully supporting Obama. Even the leading trade union in America, the Machinists Union, the most highly skilled union in the country, whose head, Mr. Buffenbarger, had repeatedly said he was not going to support Obama at the convention because he has destroyed U.S. industry, U.S. labor, has capitulated because Clinton did. His wife was brutalized by Obama. She was forced to go out and basically mouth the words of these war policies, which we know from our own contact with people in those circles that she did not really agree with, but she's been brutalized. You may remember that before the Iraq War, Bush and Cheney brutalized Colin Powell, made him go before the UN and give a speech which he knew to be absolute crap, lies about Obama, about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and chemical
weapons.
And
he delivered it, and then the media says, oh, it's a slam dunk.
Yeah, it's done, and they went to war. And he said later, this was the most horrible moment of his life, where he realized he was telling lies. Lies that he tried to correct as best he could, but he basically accepted finally the dictates of those who were saying, no, we have evidence of this. And of course, the evidence was all fabricated nonsense. So similar things have gone on against Hillary. But she's been brutalized, so you may try to explain why she's done it. But nonetheless, she's done it. Bill's gone along with it. It's an hysterical response, which is ignoring the fact that we're on the brink of World War III. If this war against Syria and Iran is unleashed, as the British are absolutely intent, Tony Blair is dedicated to making that happen. His puppet, Bibi Netanyahu in Israel, is dedicated to making that happen. In fact, the only reason it hasn't happened already is because the U.S. military, including our Joint Chief of Staff, has adamantly fought against this madness and insanity.
And I think that's a brilliant move on the military's part, because after all, they're the ones who are going to have to go over there and see their buddy shot up and die and come home and pine boxes, and the media will not be allowed to report on them. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest from LaRouchePack.com is Michael Billington. Back in a moment. Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts! and obviously get impeached under Article 25 of the Constitution. Now, speaking of people who are nuts that should have been impeached, Clinton, and it's my contention that his moral compass is so off this planet that he's officially an alien in his new name. Well, basically the same name, but you need to pronounce it correctly. I am Clinton, and that's basically who he is. Now, before he got into the presidency, he was a Arkansas governor. Under his governorship, there was an awful lot of things that happened there that were very scary. For example, a huge amount of murders of close people to him that knew lots of information about him. The Arkansas state governorship indeed contracted an awful lot of work to his wife, Hillary Clinton's law firm. And also, he was implicated in an enormous cocaine smuggling ring, as well as, at the same time, according to many state troopers who have testified, and some have been bumped off and some are still alive to this day, that he was a prolific womanizer. Like, literally, driving around almost every day, being driven by a limousine and what have you, meeting women and just having absolutely real debauched kind of commentary. And some of the state troopers are really kind of aghast, you know. They've seen people killed, they've seen robberies, rapes, murders, the whole thing like that. And they were disgusted by Bill Clinton's behavior. So naturally, he was a good running candidate for the presidency, because if you are going to be president of the United States of America, you need to have a huge amount of dirt on you so that the people who really own the United States can hold it over you and make sure that you follow their agenda to a T. And that's basically what it's all about. And the first Great Depression, back onto the economics here, was caused by, in no small part, the major corporate banks loaning out 10 times what they had in reserve so people could buy stock in the stock market. You ever hear of the Roaring Twenties, where everybody was making a heck of a lot of money on the stock market? That's because that money, just like the money today, was made up out of thin air, and then the bankers called in all their loans en masse, because there was a little contract bit there, and if you look very closely, you'll see that a lot of people who are taking out massive loans still have this premise in their contracts too, that they can call in the loans at any time, and if you can't pay for them, they take everything you got. And that was what triggered the Great Depression. The bankers did it deliberately so that they could amalgamate basically the entire economy underneath their big umbrella and usurp all the wealth. And also at the same time, during the Great Depression, the United States and its financial institutions gave some upwards of $1 trillion to Hitler during a time at which approximately 10 million Americans starved to death because there wasn't any money. And now what we've got is we've got Hillary Clinton, as Jack Blood calls her, acting in a very bloodthirsty manner in terms of Libya and Gaddafi and what have you. She's just like, yay, Gaddafi's dead. Isn't that great? He got shot in the ass. I love it. And now we have a global economy that is so teetering on the brink of war and terrifying ramifications that 10 million people starving to death in the United States as a result of the last financial depression will be pittance compared to what's about to happen. And of course, you remember, how did they get out of that last Great Depression? Oh, that's right. They started a massive war with the Germans that they funded.
That actually didn't get us out of the war. There's a big story that it took a war to get us out of the Depression. The war was necessary because the British had created this fascist hell throughout Europe. But it was actually the Roosevelt policies leading into the war which got us out of the Depression in the long run, and in fact made it possible for us to defeat fascism, which we would not have been defeated had we not built up the most massive infrastructure that the world had ever seen across the United States. Water, power, basic industry, agriculture, education and health. Something unprecedented. In the middle of a horrible depression, he was able to do that using American system ideas, which had been basically forgotten, of a creditary policy rather than a monetary policy. And we can go into that. And it's certainly worth discussing what you just brought up about the money. Wealth. The myth is that wealth is measured in money or raw materials, as the physiocrats say. It's something quite different. But I have to go back. I think it's important for me to give my objection to the characterization of the Clintons. The reality is that Clinton was put in, I think you're right, because they believed he was a controllable baby boomer from a governorship and so forth. He had capitulated. The cocaine deal you described was, in fact, run by Ollie North and Henry Kissinger. It was part of the Iran-Contra scam, which was a massive exchange of guns for in Ibero-America in exchange for cocaine, which was brought in through mostly through the Florida military Air Force base, but also through Alabama, through that, I forget the name of it now, and that this was later blamed somewhat on Clinton, but in fact it was run, he may have acquiesced, I'm not sure of how that worked. But the fact is that Clinton is a very smart guy, by the way, extremely smart guy, unlike most politicians in the modern era.
He has an IQ of like 160 or
I don't know if IQ something, is the best measure.
Something ridiculous.
True. He was smart enough to know that when he got a Rhodes Scholar and was educated in England, that he hated the British.
He hated the British system. That shows some basic intelligence.
Well, that's really ironic because the Rhodes Scholarship is named after Cecil Rhodes, who was a vehement British imperialist, and when he died. That was what Rhodesia was named after. That's after exactly Cecil Rhodes. You know, he had more gold and diamonds and everything than anybody else had ever conceived of before. And he wrote nine wills. And or was it seven? I forget which. But only one of those wills has ever been released to the public, and that's the Rhodes Scholarship. The rest of them, allegedly, were the formation of a well-funded secret society to advance the aims of the British Empire. So I find it ironic that a Rhodes Scholar would be against the British Empire.
Well, remember that Clinton studied with, the author of Tragedy and Hope.
Carol Quigley.
He studied with Quigley at Georgetown. And Quigley, of course, was one of the best of the historians who understood the British system at its core, how it had infiltrated the United States through the CFR and other institutions in order to subvert this commitment to progress. And even though Quigley didn't quite understand it, this idea of a creditary system, which had been created by Hamilton and our constitutional crowd to counter the monetary systems of Europe, to create a system that was not based on the power of money, the power of banks, but on the power of a government committed to the general welfare. So Quigley gave Obama a very good education, and Clinton pointed to that as one of the reasons he understood what he was seeing when he went to England for his education and came back with a good, healthy hatred of the British system, the aristocracy and the system itself. And he had his problems. He went along with the idea that the IT bubble was real progress, or it wasn't. It was a bubble. But in 96, 97, when the 97 so-called Asian crisis hit, you remember the 97 Asian bubble when George Soros pulled the plug on the Thai baht and the Malaysian ringgit and so forth, and you had this...
Have you noticed whenever a big crisis happens, it's almost always never accidental, like somebody's always deliberately pulled the pin on something?
And Soros, of course, I'm sure, is an employee of the Rothschild family that you referenced before. He was literally employed by Rothschild and ran much of his speculation, including the speculation against the British pound, which made him a lot of money, intentionally to make him money in order to begin running his regime change, orange revolutions, green revolutions, and so forth.
That's funny, because that dovetails with my prime minister, John Key, who bet against the New Zealand dollar, made a hell of a lot of money, then came here, became prime minister, and said about his plans to destroy the country.
John Key. I'm afraid I don't know the New Zealand history very well. John Key, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was a financial speculator. He was working with Merrill Lynch, and he's the kind of person who has the moral ethics of a snake. Like, literally, he will fire 200 people in a day and be still smiling. They called him the smiling assassin around the office.
Right.
And so, who better to be a prime minister?
Well, what happened with this so-called Asian crisis, which wasn't really Asian, LaRouche at the time said, look, this isn't an Asian crisis. This is the first blow of a collapse of the global financial bubble. And of course, it also hit Russia. It hit Brazil. It spread very rapidly. But it tended to be focused on Asia, where they had built up too much of an acceptance of the free money that was coming in. They had made their mistakes. But it was an attack by Soros and the hedge funds. Soros personally ran off with more money than the Thai government actually possessed in baht. He made more billions out of that speculation.
Isn't Soros actually a wanted man now? Like, that's why he's living in China, because the Western nations catch him and kill him.
I wish that were the case. Unfortunately, not the Western nations, but some Eastern European nations have brought charges against him correctly. But the point is this. When that happened, Clinton, who already was familiar with our work, familiar with LaRouche's work, only familiar at that point, did something that was absolutely unacceptable to the empire, to the Council on Foreign Relations, and to Wall Street. He said, perhaps we should go back and reflect on what Roosevelt did in the crisis in 1933. Perhaps we should talk about fixed exchange rates and a Bretton Woods system of the sort that did not allow speculation on currencies and other international speculation. He gave that speech, by the way, at the Council of Foreign Relations. I was in prison at the time, and I happened to be watching the speech that he gave at the Council of Foreign Relations and was absolutely stunned and learned only later that we had begun to have some contact with him, and he began to respond. From that point on, he was a dead man as far as the British Empire goes. The financial empire said, this guy is gone, he's finished, we have to get him out of the way. We're not going to succeed in what we're trying to do in wiping out the tradition of Roosevelt and the American system in the United States. He's got to go. They sent Monica Lewinsky in, an asset controlled by Lucianne Goldberg and her controller, Alan Greenspan. And, you know, they knew his weakness. They knew that they could get in his pants and play with him, and they did. And he succumbed. So he was diverted.
So to speak.
Yeah, exactly, so to speak. So, you know, the result was that Alan Gore, who is completely a British asset, the spokesman for this fraudulent global warming nonsense, a collaborator with the Russian mafia that was already involved in trying to destroy Russia, was basically put in charge. And Greenspan had a free run, and people like Larry Summers, who had taken over the Treasury Secretary, ran the destruction of Glass-Steagall, which was rammed through the Congress. That was the end. That was the end of the Roosevelt tradition and the American system of controls over the speculators. And as soon as Bush and Cheney came in, they not only launched the process of war policy on a global scale, but they launched this wild speculative bubble, which Obama not only continued but expanded and led us into the disaster that we face today. So Clinton is a very interesting character. And as I'm sure I discussed with you on the last show, we had a chance, a very real chance. This was not just speculative or, you know, our opinion or something. We're working with key people in the Democratic Party who represent what you might call the sane faction of the Democratic Party, people tied to industry and production and science and technology and culture. And we knew that Obama had to go. He absolutely could not be the candidate or the country was finished, especially when you look at the clown show being presented by the Republican Party. So fought like hell to create an environment in which, can you hear me? Something just popped up in front of me.
No, can you hear me all right? You're fine.
Okay. We fought like hell to get the Clintons and the people around the Clintons to force this idiot out of office and to put a Democratic candidate in there, either Hillary or somebody in that circle, who represented an opposition to these insane wars, an opposition to the Wall Street bailout, who would fight for Glass-Steagall, who would give us some chance of pulling out of this threat to civilization itself. Because civilization itself is now threatened, literally, economically, as well as through this threat of nuclear war, which will leave no nation untouched. They capitulated. They fell for the same reasons that Clinton was gotten at the time. You know, I mean, he has weaknesses that we understand, but he's not the devil that I think you were sort of describing before. He's somebody who had the potential of doing something, and we're still being very clear when we talk to him in his circle. You had the potential, and you blew it. So we are now mass circulating a leaflet which has a title of something like, I don't have it in front of me, something like Obama's thermonuclear war, Bill Clinton's horrible mistake, which is a warning that civilization is on the brink. And because Clinton capitulated, representing that wing of the Democratic Party, we're now in a disaster where four lunatics are running on the Republican side, a psychotic, Nero-like, warmongering fanatic, puppet of the British Empire on the Democratic side. And therefore, we have to come up with a flank to break this wide open. And I don't know if you're about to go to a break, but
we are.
Okay.
Michael. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with the fabulously psychic Michael Billington from LaRouchePack.com.
tunnel way out of here.
Sent George Soros to the Eastern European Police Interpol scumbaggery dudes. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's all about unity, ladies and gentlemen. And scumbaggery, exposing it together. And, of course, we were talking over the break with Mike Billington, and of course, I produced almost as much information and resources and stuff per day in terms of videos and radio interviews and such than the mainstream media in New Zealand does. Like, literally, if you had a look at their articles, how long it would take you to read them and how long it would take you to listen to the interviews and the videos that I do every day, you'd actually spend more time listening to the guests that I have and what have you than all the information that they produce combined. Why? Because they are lackluster on information. That is why their articles are so short. That is why their interviews and news stories are only like 30 seconds long, because there's no information contained within. And it's pretty straightforward to anybody who looks at it with a logical mind. And when we talk about logic, I'm not talking about, oh, no such thing as Rothschild exists because, oh, you know, nobody's that clever. Just think about this instead. Well, ladies and gentlemen, your media lies to you, your government lies to you, and the government, and in fact, this is a global thing, people's own governments are more likely to kill you than any other factor in the 20th century. Okay, so when you think about it, the threat is not coming from overseas. 99% of the time, the threat is real, and it is at your doorstep before you've even figured out that there's an enemy at all. So you'd all best be very well informed and figure out what is going on before it happens to you. That's why you need to support people like me and Mike Billington at LaRochePack.com and AmericanFreedomRadio.com, Chris Green from Greenwave Radio, Jack Blood from Deadline Live, and a host of others who are really busting their humps all day, every day, to expose what is planned for you so you don't wind up getting exterminated by accident.
Or by intention.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's obviously the intent of the exterminati, you know, to wipe us all out. You know, what do they want? Like 500 million, according to the Georgia Guidestones, which are erected by a secretive group. And, maybe a billion, you know? Who cares? We're all just popcorn chicken to these people. But anyway, what were we talking about over the break, Michael?
Well, we've taken a flank. You know, the history shows that a successful military strategic policy requires that you hit the enemy on their weak spot, on their flank. That you learn that if you have an enemy which is following previous ideas and linearly extending previous policy to the current policy, that they're no longer thinking clearly. And that if you understand that, you can project how they're going to act in a situation. And you, as a smaller force, even as a Gideon's army, if you know what that is, you know the Gideon's army idea from the Bible?
No.
Gideon, who told those who weren't
Gilligan's Island, but not Gideon's.
No, not Gilligan's Island. Gideon's army, who said to those who were resigning and leaving because they were facing a superior force, he said, "Go, we don't need you. We need people who understand and are committed, and with a smaller force will be more powerful against even a overwhelming majority against us, because we're committed to the truth and we're fighting on the idea of principle." That concept is very much true today, that we have to have that Gideon's army idea of how to deal with a situation, especially here in the United States, which is reaching the point of cataclysmic collapse. So what are we looking at? We're looking at a Republican Party with four absolute lunatics who are competing with each other in a bunch of debates. I guess you don't watch these horrible debates in New Zealand. You're very lucky. But they're going on now in this so-called Republican fight for who's going to be the nominee.
where they compete with who can nuke Iran faster, who can shut down the federal budget faster, who can destroy the United States and the world more rapidly than the other. These are sick people. So, and every time any one of these four opens their mouth, they are doing more to help Obama get reelected than anything else that could be done, because they're showing what absolute fools and lunatics this small crew, which does not represent the base of the Republican Party, by the way, but that this crew, which has been allowed to take over this debate and allow this phony debate process to go on, destroying each other, destroying their party, destroying America. So what are we going to do? Well, we're launching a campaign, and we're doing this on the basis of the fact that we have very, very close contact with high-level military and intelligence. And by the way, I encourage everyone to go to our website, www.larouchepac.com, LaroucePac, that's for Political Action Committee, .com, LaroucePac.com. And on there, you will see articles in our published from our Executive Intelligence Review, which go through how General Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the head of our National Intelligence Committee, and others have been in open battle against Obama and this war policy. And you will see that we have a situation in which there is an open, almost, you might almost say, a coup-type situation in the United States, where the military recognizes the insanity of launching a war against Syria or Iran and Iran, and recognizes that this will expand very rapidly into a thermonuclear confrontation with Russia, who themselves recognize that this U.S.-British policy is geared towards a open war confrontation with Russia.
Can
and
I
China.
Ask you something?
So
has Vladimir
it's absolutely
Putin
absolutely imperative that people read this documentation of what is effectively a full-scale division in the United States, which under any other system would be seen as a coup situation. It's not a coup situation because American military people recognize the coups don't work, that we have to restore American system policy. And how do you stop this disaster where you have four clowns on the Republican side and a Nero psychopath on the Democratic side? Well, our strategy is this, and we have supporters at the highest level who are thinking about this. I can't tell you who. I don't even know who. In fact, LaRouche does. He's holding certain things close to his chest. But that the idea here is that this four-man team of Republican candidates should best be known as the Obama Reelection Committee. Because every time they open their mouth, they convince people that maybe we should vote for Obama. And we're going to force a situation in which a serious Republican candidate can come to the fore even late in the game, who represents an opposition to these insane colonial wars, as our military by and large agrees, not all the military, people like Petraeus and scoundrels of this sort who have given us this disaster in Afghanistan and Iraq. They are all on the imperial side. So this is not to whitewash the military. It's mixed. But the current chief of staff, the current head of the National Intelligence Committee, and others are people who we can count on if we move on this thing quickly enough to make this work. So that's our policy. We're going to launch a campaign starting yesterday to try to sow discredit these clowns, whom we describe as the Four Stooges, or what's his name? I forget his name now. Ron Paul, who's given a lot of credit because he's opposed to the war, but who is in fact a clown.
He's the only one that's opposed to the war.
You're speaking, and I don't hear you. What's happened?
He's the only one that's opposed to the war.
I don't hear you, Vinny.
You don't?
Why don't I hear you?
Uh-oh, that's not good. Well, continue on anyway. Maybe, but continue on. Go.
I don't hear you.
Well, this is a problem. Okay, well, we're going to have to reconnect you then, Mike, if that's the problem. I'm not sure if people can hear me. So if anybody's in the chat room there, if you can't hear me, please type in if you can't or if you can.
Yes or no.
Pardon? Yeah, well, we're just reconnecting Mike now. Sorry about that technical glitch there. Ladies and gentlemen, it happens, particularly, and have you noticed, Mike?
I'm back.
Yeah.
Vinny, I haven't heard you for the last couple of minutes.
Really?
Back now. Yeah, I had to log off and log back in. I've missed the last few minutes of what you said.
All right. Well, that's good, because I was just apologizing if people couldn't hear me.
Oh, okay. I'm back on. I hope your audience is.
Mm-mm. Well, what I was saying was that Ron Paul is the only non-war candidate on the podium at all, isn't he?
That's true. But he's a fool. He's a follower of the Austrian school of economics. He believes that if the government just eliminated itself, which means essentially letting the financial institutions run themselves, run the country. And in fact, they're the people who are bringing us the very wars that he's opposed to. So yeah. You have no
choice.
Isn't
it funny? It's a real pain, isn't it? When you're given two or three or four, in fact, you're given so many false choices that you left wondering which false choice should you support this time. Do I want to be exterminated myself? Do I want to be irradiated? Do I want to be taxed to death? Do I want my food supply taken over by Monsanto? Do I want pharmaceutical drugs that'll make me go insane and shoot people in my classroom, shoved down my throat like they're Starburst? You know, there's so many choices. This is the Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Michael Billington from LaRouchePack.com. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now hour number two of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AM/FM bands all across America and internet radio stations around the world. And if you're listening to this as part of the delayed broadcast in New Zealand around the various AM/FM stations, we are actually now expanding in New Zealand. And I want to give a quick shout out specifically to Aussie Greg Selman down in Invercargill for advocating on my behalf and finding me new affiliates because, well, basically, I'm too busy making the radio show and producing the radio show and getting the guests for the radio show and doing all of that, that it's very, very difficult for me to find time to go out and find other radio stations that will pick up the show. So I want to thank him personally for that. Now, Michael Billington from LaRouchePack.com.
Vinny, if you don't mind asking me on air, I didn't know you had, in addition to the internet, I didn't know you had AM and FM affiliates. What are they? Do you have a whole lot?
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of them. American Freedom Radio is a decent size wee network. So we've got people listening in their cars and on their radios and dial in at home, as well as delayed broadcasts on the radio stations that I've got here in New Zealand in both the North and South Islands.
That's interesting to know. Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, go ahead.
But of course, the internet is the only way that we can really do this show because they're hosting this, the studio in Austin, Texas, the wonderful people there at American Freedom Radio who just basically bust their hump all day, every day to make sure that activists and researchers and commentators like myself actually have a platform of this magnitude to get it out. And in terms of the size, it's not the biggest by any measure, but it's certainly a lot bigger than most other smaller radio networks. And, well, basically, in my opinion, listening to talk radio and a lot of other different networks, even ones that are larger than American Freedom Radio, not only are the hosts and guests of comparable, if not better, quality, but also the one thing that I like about American Freedom Radio is long segments. You don't get interrupted every 5 minutes by an ad break, which just it's infuriating sometimes to listen to other networks when they do that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, no, this is very useful to have this access to the population.
here and there. I just didn't know American Freedom Radio extended all over the world.
Well, the Vinnie Eastwood show does. I'm not so sure about American Freedom Radio having affiliates and other shows. I mean, they just play my show in New Zealand as far as I know, but I want to get American Freedom Radio bigger and better and badder and actually do take it global. Like, I would really love to have affiliates in, say, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada and all of that kind of thing that play American Freedom Radio and not just my show. Because, well, basically, you can sit there and listen to American Freedom Radio all day and it's massively awesome host and guest after massively awesome host and guest and show, and it's just so brilliant. You can't. It's undeniable.
Right. Interesting.
Getting the word out is the main is the name of the game. Now we were. What were we talking about over the break?
I wanted to get back to this question of money because you were right about this. The problem is that people really believe that wealth is money, and it's not. And, you know, one of the discoveries of actually first by people like Leibniz in Europe in the 17th century and others who gave rise ultimately to the American system, the people who created this constitution, recognized that money was not wealth, that the British physiocrats and others who argued that wealth was located in the ability to print money or to mine from the earth, were liars, that wealth is located in the creative power of the mind and in the way in which the mind is capable of taking the physical resources presented to us by nature, by the historical process, the constantly changing nature of the universe, and using our discovery of the laws of those universe to transform the physical resources to the benefit of mankind as a whole. That idea was the bedrock of the founding of the American Republic. It's long been lost, as people know, and people tend to demonize America, but there's something special about the fact that this nation broke from the British, what became was already in the making the global British Empire, and created a republic on the principles similar to what Plato called the republic, and with a few key people in leadership who mobilized this nation behind these profound ideas. Now, this concept is crucial because we're now dominated globally by a monetary system. And really, the monetary system is simply another word for empire. It's another word for colonialism. It's another word for empire. The monetary system idea is that financial institutions have the power to use debt, as you've described to a certain extent, use the power of debt as a way of controlling politics and political power. And if you think about how America created a constitution which explicitly put the power over the currency in its elected government, the purpose of that was to remove the power of the banking system from determining economic policy and creating essentially a situation in which every single citizen did have a say over how the economy was to function, not only through his workplace, but through his participation in electing representatives who, as representatives of the people, had the power to determine economic policy, not the banks. Now, that's been destroyed. The creation of our Federal Reserve System in America under President Wilson was the beginning of the end of that idea, because the Federal Reserve System was set up not as a national bank controlled by the government, which ultimately is controlled by the elected representatives of the people, but the Federal Reserve, as most central banks, are in fact private banking institutions allied to run the economy of nations. In a monetarist system, a creditary system as devised by the founding fathers would take that power away from the private bankers and make them subordinate to the idea of the general welfare run by the national bank. Not to say that the government is going to be perfect in what they do, obviously not, but at least that way the population and the individual citizen of a nation and citizen of the world will have a power to act upon the economic and therefore also the cultural and strategic policies of a nation. That's what's at stake today.
And this is as opposed to the very fictional money that they can. I mean, these people are fictional characters, kind of like He-Man, you know, by the power of debt, I vanquish thee. And because all this debt has been made up out of thin air, like by sleight of hand magic, my solution to this is just as creative. Why don't we just pretend this debt doesn't exist and write it off the books?
You have to distinguish between the debt, which was in fact debt extended towards productive investment or necessary infrastructure, either physical infrastructure or the so-called social infrastructure like education and health and so on. But nonetheless, you can make those distinctions. It's not going to be easy. If we implement Glass-Steagall again here in the U.S. and globally, it means going into the banking system and basically dividing up their debts between those that are purely speculative and those which represented debts into something productive of one sort or another, either productive in the sense of direct investments into industry and agriculture, or those into the increasing of the productive power of the population through education and health and so on. We can do it. It's not going to be easy. And especially it's going to be difficult because, unfortunately, pension funds, municipal bonds, and so forth have largely been dragged into this horrendous derivatives bubble. So there's lots of pensions and city and state debt and so forth, which has been corrupted. So this is going to be difficult to deal with. But to say, oh, well, it's difficult, therefore we won't do it, is to basically throw up your hands and give in to a global, not only a global depression, but a dark age, global war, and a very real threat to the very existence of civilization as we know it.
Yeah. So, I mean, everybody's life needs to be put on hold in order to deal with this. I mean, that's level of priority for me, basically. You know, I wanted to be a filmmaker and make Hollywood movies and whatever. I may have wanted to be a salesman or anything like that. I may have wanted to have kids or anything. That's all on the back burner now because the alternative is being exterminated or being irradiated. You know, it's pretty straightforward, you know. Where do your priorities lie, people?
You know, there's an irony, which is that, in fact, just today the news headlines were that there's a meteor heading towards the Earth. This is very real, you know. There are periods of mass extinction in history, five of them altogether, in which most species were extinguished. What happened out of each of those is that those species which were most headed towards a shift in the way in which species lived, that they lived at a higher order, survived these mass extinctions. But, you know, the way of the dinosaurs and so forth was that they were not in a mode of committed to a higher, what's called energy flux density, a higher mode of transforming the power of the sun, of the earth, those things that have been sort of stored up in the biosphere, towards more rapid rates of productive advance, became extinct. Now, we have a human race right now which is acting like dinosaurs, politically and scientifically. When you look at the fact that Obama has taken down the NASA program, which is the only hope we have of dealing with incoming meteors, who have the capacity to deal with the extraordinary shift that's taking place right now in solar activity, which is having a huge impact on our Earth in the form of weather, extreme weather conditions like, for instance, volcanoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so forth, which are caused by the kind of shifts in the magnetic fields on the Earth, caused by very dramatic shifts going off in the sun. And you can read about this. If you log into Google, you can check it on it, but it's not considered serious. But in fact, it's the most serious thing we could think about as human beings. So here we have a president who not only is destroying and an entire European leadership, who are not only destroying the very bedrock of the global financial system in order to preserve their financial system at the expense of the real economy in Europe, in the United States, and actually around the world,
But they're also taking down the only means we have of protecting against what will come, maybe in the next million years, but maybe in the next 50 years. A great threat to civilization in the form of meteor or other galactic effects, which we have to be in space. We have to be on Mars. We have to be on the moon and then Mars and beyond in order to begin to create a situation in which this unique human species with the creative power of mind is capable of dealing with threats to the species as a whole. And the threat as a whole from meteors and the threat as a whole from the threat of thermonuclear war have to be seen as one and the same thing. That this is a question of whether the moral capacity of our population, not only in the U.S. but globally, is up to the task of dealing with a existential crisis to civilization itself, as you just described. It's true. And the LaRouche movement is unique precisely in that sense, is that we've built an international movement. Part of what you'll find in our current issue of Executive Intelligence Review is reports on the growing number of Russian scholars, military leaders, and political leaders who are making this same warning today. People in China, similarly, that these are issues which are going to determine whether or not the human race survives this current crisis, economic, social crisis, and even the galactic crisis.
Isn't there some form of demonization happening towards Russia in terms of their support for Syria at the moment?
One of my contributors,
Evelyn Gilbert, as little as yesterday, told me that Russia, Putin specifically, was kicking the international financiers and the private bankers out of Russia virtually en masse, and now they're packing up their bags of non-existent money and leaving. And as a direct result, basically, we now have this big crisis sort of looming in terms of war because Russia's no longer playing ball with these international banksters.
I wouldn't put it the same way, but it's the right idea. Yeah, I mean, Putin is an extraordinary figure, somebody who people have to recognize. In fact, part of our general campaign right now is to use this absolutely disgusting effort by the British to demonize Putin as some sort of a new Stalin. Why? As unfortunately Hillary Clinton said, the despicable idea that Russia and China vetoed the bill before the United Nations, which, like the bill that was used in Libya, although it doesn't say it explicitly, was obviously intended to justify a military intervention that would have turned Syria into the same hellhole that we now have in Libya, as we have in Iraq, as we have in Afghanistan. In other words, the British intention here is not to bring democracy to countries which have dictators. That's nonsense. This is the intention to create massive chaos, whose purpose is to justify their intent of provoking a war against Asia, Russia, China, India, and the other nations of Asia, including Japan and Korea, who are going to be drawn into this crisis. So, I mean, this is, you're absolutely right. The demonization of Putin is aimed at the fact that he has, in fact, he and Medvedev, even though there was an attempt to try to make people think that Putin and Medvedev were on opposite sides of the coin or something. But when they announced that Putin would be the candidate for president, the election's tomorrow, by the way, not tomorrow, Saturday.
Wasn't there an assassination attempt on Putin as well?
There was an assassination attempt. There's every attempt to demonize him. The George Soros-linked NGOs are all over Russia preparing to declare the election a fraud, even though every poll by international as well as domestic interests show that Putin will win probably between 55 and 65% of the vote. But as soon as that vote happens, you'll see the media will report vote fraud and so forth, and therefore they're preparing for what could very well be, starting this weekend, an all-out effort to stir up the justification of a full-scale war against Russia. This
Which
will be thermonuclear.
Absolute insanity. It's insanity. Absolutely. It's insanity. It's insanity. Ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake. The people who run your country, the people who dictate your financial policy, the people who make sure foreign policy goes out the way it does, have lost their freaking minds. Here's the question. Do you support madness? Of course you don't. Do you understand madness? Of course you don't, because you'd have to be a mad person in order to understand it, wouldn't you? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest. Man, this is a wicked interview. I cannot wait for more from Mike Billington from LaRouchePack.com. Back in a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, if you can wait.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the darkest 2 hours in talk radio. It's dark because we're not brightening it up with BS like the mainstream media. Although, I do like it when the very sexy blonde media reporter gives me sex eyes through the television. Oh, yeah, yes. And in fact, this is the way they play it. They put some sexy broad in there, and it's like, oh, I'm going to tell you about how being exterminated and vaccinated on air is all so nice and good for you. Yes, it's going to be fabulous. Oh, and look at how pretty I am. I don't know anything about what the frack is going on. I'm just reading a fracking teleprompter. Just like Obama. Isn't he just kind of like a cheerleader these days, you know? And I was talking with Chris Green yesterday, Michael, that he's actually just getting bored of Barack Obama speeches. You know those little bobblehead things that you get in your car, you know, so whenever you're driving along, the little head moves sort of thing, you know, up and down. We don't want to get one like that with Barack Obama, except moving up and down, he moves from side to side, just exactly the same way as he reads from teleprompter on the left to the right, and his eyes never actually contact the audience at any point.
Yeah, no, it's true. This guy was trained as a sophist at Yale as a lawyer, meaning you can argue any side and make it, you know, sound good. You can successfully persuade people that you mean to support one policy and then support the exact opposite. He was picked up by George Soros long before his presidential campaign. The hedge funds and Soros in particular financed his rise to power along with his crew of Chicago organized crime types, Redsco and others. But that this campaign was launched, and we were discussing Clinton before, it was launched because the threat that Hillary Clinton would be president at a time when they knew that Lyndon LaRouche was in close collaboration, not that Bill Clinton and Hillary did everything Lyndon LaRouche wanted, that's not the case, but close collaboration with a person who was capable of thinking, who had the capacity to begin implementing the programs LaRouche was advocating, and they said this will not be allowed, will not allow Hillary or Bill or Lyndon LaRouche in the White House. And so they launched this multi-billion-dollar campaign to put this sophist, this teleprompter reader, into office, who is, as LaRouche identified in an April 2009 global telecast, who reproduces the Nero, a narcissist who believes he can walk on water, who believes he has access to supernatural powers, the one, as they said in his campaign, and who, unfortunately, is totally controlled by this financial empire, the City of London, Wall Street crowd, the so-called British Empire, to carry out policies which will, in fact, lead to the extermination of the human race if they're not stopped. And that's not an exaggeration, or at least the human race as we know it today. So that's who he is. Anybody who doesn't see it is lying, or they're simply blind. But most do see it, and they've been persuaded only by the fact that this Republican crew of lunatics being run against him are so crazy, so insane, that they think, well, in comparison, I guess we better vote for Obama. Well, this is precisely what was intended. It has to be broken, and therefore we are committed to doing what's required to bring a serious Republican candidate, now that the Clintons have capitulated and are not going to fight to have a different Democratic candidate. We're going to fight to create a separate Republican candidate
We have some ideas who is thinking about these things. We know that we're dealing here with a core group of America's military leadership and intelligence community leadership who realize we're at a situation which under other than a republic's environment would be thought of as a coup situation. Well, we're not going
to
have
We'd have to be talking about a snap election, because in my analysis, Barack Obama is very similar to New Zealand's current Prime Minister, John Key, where he was placed in his position to destroy the country. And because the country isn't destroyed yet, he's obviously going to be reelected.
Well, I, like I said, I'm afraid I have to admit ignorance to the situation in the New Zealand electoral situation or the political leadership. But it sounds right. This is of course a global phenomenon. When Obama did his trip to Asia in November, up till that time, Hillary, who was acting largely independent of the White House, Obama had, under his British tutelage, focused on the Middle East and Europe, and had allowed Hillary and her deputy Kurt Campbell to largely run the situation in Asia. And that's led to some very decent developments. For instance, just today, the North Korean situation seems to be moving towards a restoration of what Bill Clinton did back in 1994, where there was an open agreement where we were going to build a nuclear plant for the North. The IAEA was there inspecting their nuclear program. And it was only when Bush and Cheney tore that apart that they were sort of driven, actually, to build a nuclear weapon and so forth. But now we seem to be back on the same course. We have decent relations with Myanmar, which is, of course, positive. But Obama went to Asia in November and effectively declared the neocon policy of the pre-9/11 era, which is that China is the greatest demon in civilization, is back on the table. That we're going to launch a military confrontation by deploying massive military forces into Australia. And as I'm sure you know, it's not just 2,000 Marines. They're going to have open basing rights for their aircraft carrier groups, for the largest aircraft, military aircraft that we have, not only in Darwin, but in several other sites. They convinced the puppet president in the Philippines, Noynoy Aquino, the son of Cory Aquino, who was placed in power by George Shultz and Paul Wolfowitz back in 86 when they overthrew Marcos, the last truly patriotic leader of that nation. But his son is now president. They convinced him to allow the U.S. to restore the massive military and naval base capacity at that state, run under sort of a subterfuge of saying it's not bases, which is illegal under their constitution now. But they're there. Why? Because the Andy Marshall policy of air-sea defense, which is now the official Obama policy, which is preparation for war on China using air-sea capacity, requires having not only the Australian base, which is out of reach of the Chinese missiles, but also the Philippine base, which of course is there for immediate military deployment capacity, with the U.S. submarine fleet being the primary assault weapon, which within a matter of minutes could lay waste to much of China and a good portion of Russia. So these are the situation we're living in, sparked at any moment by a Israeli attack on Iran, where everyone knows Israel couldn't even, you know, do a dent on Iran's capacity in any way, whose only purpose is to drag
unless
the US
they used in. Unless they used the 300 nuclear warheads that they have.
Even with their nukes, they would lay waste to Iran, but they wouldn't do anything to stop Iran's nuclear program, either peaceful or military, which they don't have. But it wouldn't affect it. The purpose is to drag the United States into the war, and the purpose is not to have the United States in a war with Iran. It's to have the United States in a war with Russia. Remember that Roosevelt built an alliance of the United States, Russia, and China. That is the greatest danger to the empire. The idea that these great historic nations, with the majority of the world's population, independent of the British Empire and most of Europe, have the capacity to impose a new monetary system, or rather a new creditary system, to replace the monetary system disaster. That the British will not tolerate. to deal with that, they must keep the United States as an enemy of Russia and China. They must drag the U.S. into a confrontation with our natural allies, with whom we could be developing great infrastructure, like the tunnel under the Bering Strait, like the development of the Far East of Russia, and so on.
This is how the Rothschilds work. They build nations up, and then they play them off against each other and destroy them, and then emerge as the victors themselves every time.
It's classic empire. You choose your leading potential enemy, and you ally with everyone else against them. You get them to be involved in your fight against them. Once they're destroyed, then, of course, you pick the next potential powerful enemy, and you get everybody else to join with you against them.
Their enemy now is the American people themselves.
It has been since the American Revolution. Ultimately, the British aim is to destroy this threat of what the American Revolution represented. They tried in the Revolution itself. They tried in the War of 1812. They tried in the Civil War, which, of course, was a British-run operation where the slave system in the South was feeding the Manchester textile mills, but more importantly, was dividing America. And their intention was to divide America. They funded the war in the South. It was Lincoln and his commitment to actually American system economic policies, his use of the so-called greenback policy to generate credit for yeoman farmers, technology-proud farmers, industry, and it was the industry and the technology-proud farmers that defeated the slaveocracy system in the South. When that failed, the British set in motion what they recognized was going to have to be a long-term subversive operation against America.
And that's Roosevelt, when they founded the Council on Foreign Relations.
All of these institutions, exactly, were meant to bring this British free market, free trade policy in to destroy the American system of creditary policies, government-directed credit to the purpose of the general welfare. Roosevelt, of course, threw a monkey wrench in that operation. Truman, who took over when Roosevelt died much too early, was an outright British puppet. And even though Roosevelt had told Churchill to his face that we were not fighting World War II to sustain the empires of Europe, and, of course, Winston Churchill was furious about that. But when Roosevelt died and this very small figure, Truman, came in, he basically worked with the British to bring the empire back into Asia and Africa. And as a result, we had to suffer through this 30 years of hideous warfare in Asia, the Vietnam War and so forth, which was totally unnecessary.
I find that the warfare of the United States during World War II and after World War II, as Eisenhower said, is the military-industrial complex that was built up. Essentially, a lot of manufacturing jobs and what have you had been created in order to fight the Nazis. And once the Nazis were defeated, they had all this military apparatus, and virtually the economy itself was centered around the military. And so they had to start finding new enemies.
That's true. But it's very important to note that what we built up as the arsenal of democracy, so-called, for the war against the fascists in Japan and Germany, actually had already existed. What Roosevelt did was that he transformed the productive capacity of our auto industry and other key industries into war production. He transformed, working with the head of the unions at that time, the head of the UAW, the auto workers union at that time, transformed the auto making and truck making capacity into Jeep and tank and airplane making capacity. When the auto industry here collapsed in 2006 and 2007, LaRouche immediately proposed that we follow the tradition that Roosevelt and Walter Reuther, the UAW chief at the time, said, and let's not shut down this auto productive capacity. We probably have too many cars anyway. We should go to rail. We should be using rail instead of these highways that are great big parking lots during every rush hour. But we should be using rail and produce the high-speed rail cars and other parts that we can produce for the nuclear industry and other things in the auto sector, which has this machine tool capacity and some of the most skilled workers that the world has ever known, who can transform those machine tools to produce anything we need. If we had a vision of creating the NOAAPA project that I discussed with you, this North American Water and Power Alliance, if we had the vision of creating high-speed and maglev rail across the United States and across the world, if we had the vision and the mission concept of a human race committed to building the world and space, then these machine tool capacities would be absolutely valuable instead of getting shut down as they were.
And previously, the United States, despite the fact that their workers were the highest paid, the highest skilled, they were also producing the cheapest, most highest quality products.
Exactly.
And today, people don't know how that can happen. It's like, well, actually, that's the environment you breed when you talk about making efficiency, when you talk about actually appreciating, upskilling your workers and paying them what they're worth. Everything gets better.
Right. Yep, you got that exactly right. That was the idea, that transforming our industry into low-income places like China and Vietnam and so forth was a myth, because the problem in China, and China is aware of this problem, by the way, and they're facing it today, is that they did not have the infrastructure that we had in the United States, which made it possible for their workforce to become these productive employees in such industries, because in fact the infrastructure didn't exist, and they were basically being underpaid, wildly underpaid, in the sense that the money needed to build that infrastructure was in America, was built into the industrial structure and the wage structure, so that your population had the money to live a life which could utilize the productive output of the industry.
And not to mention, if you are being paid a substantial amount, it means you can also purchase stuff which helps the economy grow. It's a closed loop feedback cycle, people. We'll be right back with Mike Billington from LaRochePack.com. Back in a minute.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
The following is a list of impoverished nations.
Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man.
I've been everywhere. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, the cackle that you hear in the background, is Mike Billington. And what I like to do on this show, usually in the final segment, because that's the only time I remember, is to ask them to divulge, preferably try to ask them to divulge, a little bit of something that perhaps they've, it's never come up in the conversation on air before, or maybe it's a bit risque, and because we all self-censor a lot. And me, personally, I don't like the whole idea of censorship, let alone self-censorship. So I encourage my guests to say if there's anything that you haven't really said before.
Oh, there's now's your time millions, to say it. Millions of things I haven't said before on air. I'll say this. I mean, I enjoyed your last musical interlude there and the list of destitute states. But, you know, the culture that has come to dominate the world from the 1960s, the rock, drug, sex counterculture from the United States. I went through this. I'm now 66 years old. So I was part of the boomer 1960s culture. Went through seeing the, you know, the rock phenomena and the drugs and the free sex and so forth. So what is this? This was the core of the British Empire assault on the United States and the idea that America had represented. The idea that the human mind is something higher than its sense perceptions. Because what is rock? What is sex? What is rock and roll? Well, of course, I mean, sex
is not to be disparaged. It's a beautiful part of human relationships. But the idea of sex for its own sake, free sex, perverted sexes and so forth, goes along with this degeneration of culture to the point where the music that we call the music of our age is mostly loud, raucous noise that appeals to the senses only, not to the mind at all. You know, you listen to Beethoven, you listen to Bach, you listen to Mozart, you realize that you're dealing here with somebody who are taking musical ideas and developing them through profound transformations, whose purpose is to reach into the mind of the human being and to reach that part of the human mind which is creative, that part which is not responsive to simply to the bodily sensual functions, but is creative. And it's that which distinguishes the human being from the beast. It's that which makes us in the image of God. It's that which gives us the power to deal with these kinds of crises by oligarchs who think human beings can be treated like beasts, can be manipulated by their senses, as the baby boomers are, as even Bill Clinton was, who can be manipulated by feeling good for the moment, who instead, rather than realizing that who we are is what we leave for posterity, that what we create for our grandchildren and our greater grandchildren, that's who we really are. What does immortality mean? Does it only mean some magical religious concept of living in heaven someplace? No. It means that we have the creative power to discover and to create music, art, science, culture, economies, things that will be lasting. If you go to our website, again, LaRouchePub.com, and you go to... Actually, we have another website, LaRouche Pub, P-U-B, is the LaRouche Publications, our E-I-R website, rather than LaRouche Pack.
It's not a place where you can buy beer?
No, pub for publications. But the LaRouche Pack website, which has our videos, one I encourage people to watch is called Nawapa 1964, and it begins with speeches by John F. Kennedy in inaugurating a series of dams, at which he says, "We're here because 30 years ago, people realized we were going to need water to transform this region of the country. And 30 years ago, those people launched this project, which is now going to benefit us. The question is," said John Kennedy, "what will the people in the year 2000 say about what we did here in 1962? Are we living in order to create a better world for that future, or are we only concerned with what we can get for ourselves today?" And this is it's a practical expression of a more profound concept of what immortality is all about. And unfortunately, our populations have been horribly dumbed down by the rock culture, by the drugs and the countercultural mentality, to think of only what satisfies your immediate personal sensual gratification, rather than what satisfies the mind, which provides real happiness, the happiness that Leibniz talked about. The happiness, by the way, which Leibniz loaned to the United States for our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, which referred to the pursuit of happiness as a fundamental right of human beings. That didn't mean, getting drunk and getting laid. It meant the power, the capacity to develop the creative powers of every mind which has those potentials through great education, through great culture, through great civilization. And this is what's lacking. If we don't inspire our populations and our leaders to act on that basis, nothing less, then we are not going to survive as a species. We are literally looking at disillusion. And I'll tell you a little story from prison. If people want to read my book, which is called Reflections of an American Political Prisoner, which I wrote the last 2 years I was in prison in 99 and 2000. In there, I describe a story where in one of the prison situations where I and one of my co-defendants from the LaRouche organization, Paul Gallagher, were in the same prison for about 2 years. And we created a chorus. A chorus that sang classical music. We sang Bach. We sang Brahms. We sang, among other things, a piece from the only opera by Beethoven called Fidelio, in which at one point the prisoners in the chorus
are allowed out into the open air. And they sing a absolutely beautiful aria called O Welche Lust, O What Joy, or the prisoner's chorus. So my prisoners in my prison sang the prisoner's chorus, dressed up as real prisoners, by the way. But this was something which these people who had never sung anything beautiful, anything classical in their lives, but each and every one of them and the people who heard it, but especially the ones who sang it, came up to me at some point afterwards and said, you know, I can't express what this means to me, that there's something inside me that goes beyond this horrible, ugly life that I've been handed and this prison sentence, but not just the prison sentence, the degraded life, which has become customary to many Americans, that this is something I can participate in, creating real beauty. And it's that sense of joy, that sense of happiness, which is lacking for the 99.9% of the population in our youth. If we don't give our youth that potential in science, in great art, then we're dead. We're doomed. Absolutely doomed.
And the fact that you've been a political prisoner and that here you are at it again is true testament to the fact that the correctional system just doesn't work.
Well, no, it's absolutely true that, you know, it used to be the fact that our prison system did something to try to rehabilitate people. They used to bring in people who would teach you creative writing and science and culture. They don't do that anymore. I don't know if it's the same in New Zealand, but the U.S., which has, I think, the highest percentage of its population incarcerated than any nation on earth. I think that's true.
And number two in New Zealand.
You think so? But they've, you know, transformed this into warehousing of young people, keeping them there as long as possible, because that serves a political purpose of making a politician sound like he's tough on crime. And, of course, releasing them ultimately to become criminals again. So it's a situation in which how you know this, even the Bible said, how you treat the least among us is what you think about the population, you know. So how you treat your incarcerated population reflects the view of mankind. And it's this British imperial view that man is an animal, the Aristotelian view that certain people are born masters and certain people born slaves, as opposed to the Platonic idea that the human mind distinguishes the human being as somebody who has an ultimate purpose in the world. And it's through that purpose and that mission that each and every individual has the right to the respect and the potential of being truly human and experiencing that joy of being human. If we don't fight for that, we're not going to survive. It's pure and simple at this point.
Exactly. These things are not privileges that can be taken away. They are rights that are simply being denied for the most part. And I think that, you know, we do have that responsibility as people who are aware of this phenomenon about how we have basically, in general, stopped caring about each other, stopped forgiving each other, stopped wanting to actually play a positive role in this world. And it's not our own fault that the mindset has been bestowed upon us.
Yeah, you know,
it's the British Empire's fault. It's brainwashing. Now, I think that's a nice, positive, airy note to leave it on. So if you want to hear more from Mike Billington, go to LaRouchePack.com and LaRouchePub.com as well. And thank you so much, Michael. It's been a really stimulating show today.
Thank you, Vinny. It's very, very, very enjoyable indeed. Thanks.
All right, and you can check up the archives, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and guerrillamedia.co.nz. And if you can subscribe for $5 a month to support the broadcast, you will get access to commercial-free archives and exclusive off-air interviews on video. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again sometime.